From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And if you are not yet wearing a mask when you go out in public, you may soon be asked to do so by the Coronavirus Task Force. Dr. Anthony Fauci said today that the task force is close to a determination on whether to recommend the broad use of masks once there are enough for all the healthcare workers. We're going to check in now on three places in the next few minutes, starting with Atlanta, which is under a stay-at-home order. More than 100 people have died across the state of Georgia from coronavirus. Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms joins us now. Mayor, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Atlanta has been under your stay-at-home order for a week now, but Georgia's Governor Brian Kemp has not issued a stay-at-home order for all of Georgia. Do you think he should?
You know, if it were my choice, there would be a stay-at-home order for the entire nation. I do think consistency would be helpful, but I certainly understand the governor's perspective. What he said is that we still have several counties that have not, that don't yet have anyone who's tested positive. But as we heard on yesterday hearing from the White House, it's just a matter of time. And it's been helpful that that finally has been acknowledged on the federal level. And so I'm hoping that our governor is continuing to listen to the experts, as I know he has been. And it is my hope that we have something statewide, even in our metropolitan Atlanta area. It has been a bit frustrating. We are a city of 500,000 people. Our metropolitan area is around 6 million people. But thankfully, with our stay-at-home order that we've issued in the city of Atlanta, many other surrounding cities have followed. But not all of them. So it's my hope that we have some consistency.
How prepared are Atlanta's hospitals to deal with the caseload right now? And what about a week or two from now?
Well, what we know, being the capital city, a major urban center, on a normal day, our hospitals are nearly at capacity. Just anecdotally, I checked in with a friend who works in one of the local emergency rooms this morning, and I was told that we are about 80 to 90% at Grady Hospital, which is our major hospital in the city that serves many of our underserved and uninsured communities. The good news, well, let me go to the bad news first. We had a flood in that hospital a couple of months ago, and so our beds are already, we don't have as many beds as we normally have. But the good news is that many of our hospital partners are already expanding their capacity and looking at sites throughout the city when and if it comes to the point that we need to expand our footprint. And so being able to watch states like Massachusetts and New York and Washington and other areas that have seen the surge, we at least have a very good idea of what to expect if the worst happens. And have ample opportunity to prepare. And I'm trusting that our state partners are doing their job to make sure that we're adequately prepared.
And let me just finally ask you just briefly, are you getting what you need from the federal government?
We could all use more. I don't think that there is a governor or mayor in this country that can honestly say that they are getting what they need. What we know in Georgia right now is that we are not testing asymptomatic patients. We're not testing people with mild symptoms. So we do know that our rates of positive tests are artificially low. It's my hope that with the rapid testing, that will improve significantly. But we just aren't testing everyone who needs to be tested. And I don't think there's a city or state who says that they have everything they need. And even when we talk about PPE, certainly it's important for our healthcare workers. But from a municipal perspective, we still have sanitation workers out on the street. We still have people who are fixing water lines. And so we are in need of PPE equipment as well. And that's certainly very difficult to find right now.
That is Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's go to Philadelphia, where officials worry they're just 2 weeks from becoming New York City. There are over 1,000 cases in Philly. Not surprising, it's the most in Pennsylvania. Member station WHYY health and science reporter Nina Feldman is here. And Nina, the city wanted to use the recently closed Hahnemann University Hospital to expand capacity that could have held up to 500 patients. But officials now say they can't use it because they can't afford it. This got nasty. What happened here?
Yeah, so Hahnemann was a safety net hospital right downtown Philadelphia. It closed last summer. Its owners declared bankruptcy, much to the dismay of a lot of residents there. It was a nearly 200-year-old beloved institution that served many of the city's poor, and it's just been sitting empty. So it was sort of an obvious choice as a potential overflow site as the city is anticipating a surge of positive COVID-19 patients. But the owner of the building was charging, the city officials said, was charging too high a price for the city to be able to afford. They wanted about $1 million a month. The city said they just couldn't swing that. And the mayor slammed the owner of the building, saying essentially, you know, this guy's just trying to jack up the price in the midst of a public health emergency and doesn't really have the health and safety of Philadelphians in mind. So
we know
the mayor abandoned those negotiations as a result.
And some people vandalized the owner's house. It got really tough there. These are tough times. But where else is the city looking for beds?
Yeah, so soon after announcing that the negotiations had fallen flat, the mayor said that Temple University had stepped up and the basketball arena there will be able to serve as a makeshift facility, serving about 250 people, probably not critically ill COVID patients, but people who, you know, maybe have milder cases and still need medical attention.
Well, we know that your governor hasn't put the whole state under stay-at-home orders, but places around Philadelphia, they have. The mayor there was scolding some residents because they were still going out, so they were closing parks, boarding up basketball parks. So in the few seconds we have, are people staying in now?
Yeah, I think Philadelphians were slow to adapt to the social distancing requirements, but it seems like it's definitely getting better and people are heeding the call and understanding that how successful that social distancing is really determines how many of those hospital beds we're going to need and how quickly. So I think the message is starting to get through.
WHYY health and science reporter Nina Feldman, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, meanwhile, in China, where the pandemic began, the manufacturing sector appears to be rebounding as authorities allow some factories to reopen. That's according to a survey released by the government. Joining us now is NPR's Emily Feng, who's in Beijing. And Emily, we know that China delayed reporting the coronavirus outbreak when it started late last year. Can we trust this report that there are signs the economy is recovering?
We can, and the numbers actually aren't too rosy. The numbers today from that index showed that China's economy is just above contracting, so it's basically the same as it was a year ago. And that's not because China's economy has returned to levels before the coronavirus pandemic, but simply people are going back to work now. So we've seen a sharp rebound, but that's simply because there was zero economic activity last month.
And when you say people are going back to work now, when you walk out into the streets in Beijing, does it look like normal? Are people going back to work?
It is almost back to normal. Some office spaces are still mandating that only 50% of employees return to the office at any given time, but traffic has returned. Many restaurants have reopened. There is more foot traffic. China is slowly coming back to life.
And what about in Wuhan, where this all started? What do we know about the situation in Hubei province?
They have slowly started to restart some businesses. They've restarted some public transportation. And next week, they're going to lift quarantine measures and let people leave the city. But there is some confusion about the extent to which life can restart in Wuhan. Some shops opened today, only to close a few hours later by overzealous officials. For almost a week now, Wuhan has reported zero new cases of the coronavirus. So officials are really, really intent on keeping that number at zero every single day. That means despite orders from above to restart business, on the ground, local officials are very wary of doing so in case that leads to new infections. And so there's been a lack of clarity of what to do.
Emily, every time I talk to you, I feel like we're looking into our future because China is at least a couple of months ahead of the United States in dealing with the coronavirus. on the other side of this, has China or will China change in fundamental ways because of what happened?
It's a little too early to say, but a couple of things that I think are notable given the worst of the outbreak in China has passed. The first is people here are even more willing than before to accept surveillance technology that monitors where they go, where they shop, their personal travel history in the name of public health. That kind of monitoring infrastructure that was set up to battle an epidemic will likely stay long after the epidemic is over. And the second is this renewed confidence in China's ability, not just as a global political leader, but as a global health provider. People in China very much see themselves at the forefront of combating this new coronavirus. And it doesn't help that a good half of the people I talk to here firmly believe the coronavirus began in the U.S. and was spread to China through the U.S. military, which is an unfounded conspiracy theory with no evidence at all. But we're seeing a divergence of narratives about how the virus began and how it was managed.
That is NPR's Emily Feng in Beijing. Emily, thank you.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
More than 30 states have urged hospitals and healthcare systems to cancel all elective surgeries during the coronavirus outbreak. It's something the Surgeon General of the United States and the American College of Surgeons have recommended. Joining us now is Dr. David Hoyt, who is the Executive Director of the American College of Surgeons. Dr. Hoyt, welcome. And do you think that all elective surgeries should be canceled right now, even in hospitals where there may not be COVID-19 patients yet?
Well, that's a changing thing in that 2 weeks ago, we put out guidelines trying to suggest elective surgeries that could be canceled. But as we realize the incidence of disease is more prevalent than we thought, and as in anticipation of communities becoming overwhelmed with infected patients, it's just wise to cancel as much elective surgery as is possible, recognizing that there are patients that still need surgery. So in the past week, what we've done with all surgical societies and across all surgical procedures is create a set of guidelines for surgeons to work with their patients to cancel those things that can be, prioritize those things that need more urgent attention, and try and give the patients hope at the same time, allowing them to participate in not exposing themselves or others to this potential virus.
Give me an example of a surgery that would be so urgent that it needs to be done right now, even in spite of the risks.
Well, let me start by saying an operation like appendicitis or a broken bone, things like that. Some of those things, people are exploring how to treat them without an operation. But in general, true emergent surgeries are still being done and should be done. The more urgent category that some people would call an elective category would be somebody that has cancer, for instance, who's been scheduled for an operation, and it makes little difference whether the operation is put off for a couple of weeks or maybe even 3 or 4 weeks. That's the kind of patient we're talking about.
Is it possible to separate parts of the hospital in some places where one side of it would just be for COVID, but the other side could be people that have to get other things done?
That's exactly what hospitals are doing, and they're reorganizing themselves. I think some hospitals, as they become literally overwhelmed with COVID patients, will have to cancel most of surgery except for emergencies. Or in their community, they will divert those patients that have a true emergency to another hospital that's not as overwhelmed. That kind of problem of triaging patients even to another facility is something we've been able to do very effectively in this country for decades with the trauma system. So when one trauma hospital is overwhelmed, we take patients to another hospital that's open for the most recent trauma case. And you're going to see as communities get saturated or overwhelmed, a particular hospital gets overwhelmed, that they'll start to do that as well. Right now, within a hospital, though, you could separate an area for more elective things and then concentrate the COVID patients in other parts of the hospital.
Dr. Hoyt, obviously everybody's just trying to get through this crisis right now, and it's hard to look much beyond. But do you think that with all of the postponements and cancellations of elective surgery that will happen in the coming weeks, that there's going to be a big backlog at hospitals once they start back up again?
Yes, and that's a very good question, and I know that that concerns a lot of patients. But we've actually, in addition to the work we've done on trying to triage patients now, we've already started to model a ramp up. So we will use criteria that would then turn our attention when we can safely to those patients that have the most urgent need, and that's why the guidelines are so important. And then we will appropriately scale up to catch up. And the surgeons in this country are totally committed to that when we're at that point.
Finally, let me just ask you, what would your advice be to people, maybe some of our listeners, who have surgery scheduled in the next couple of weeks that most likely will be canceled?
Well, I know that they're concerned, and they should be in contact with their providers to be assured that they haven't been forgotten. And people will get to you and assure that your procedure is done as soon as it possibly can be. I think a broader message for everybody right now, so that we don't overwhelm the healthcare system, don't overwhelm the operating rooms to the best we can, is to try and stay at home right now. That's the single most important thing we can all do to lower the incidence of the disease. The more we can do to contain the frequency of patients that get it, the faster we're going to be able to get back to surgery, the faster we're going to be able to care for everybody that needs care.
That is Dr. David Hoyt, who is the executive director of the American College of Surgeons. Dr. Hoyt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
14 states have now postponed presidential primaries because of the COVID-19 crisis, and calls for mail-in voting are growing. But right now, only 5 states conduct all of their elections entirely by mail. One of them is Washington State. And joining us now is Washington's Secretary of State, Kim Wyman. She's on Skype. Kim Wyman, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. It's good to be on.
So have you been getting a lot of phone calls from other states about how voting in Washington works?
Oh, absolutely. My elections director, Lori Agino, and I have probably fielded at least 25 calls between the two of us.
And what do you tell people? How does voting by mail work in Washington State? How does someone cast a ballot? And is there any in-person voting?
So in Washington State, every one of our 4.5 million registered voters receives a ballot by mail in every election they're eligible to vote in. And basically how it works is they take out the ballot, they fill it out, complete it, put it into a security envelope, which has no identifying marks, and that's how we keep their voter secrecy. And then it goes into an outer mailing envelope that they sign and attest to an oath that says that they are eligible to participate. They either mail it back with, we have prepaid postage in our state, or we have about 500 drop boxes around the state where voters can drop those in, and those ballots are returned to the county election offices, and they're processed and counted there, and results are posted on election night at 8 o'clock.
And how do you make sure it's secure?
Our big check is that we have their voter registration signature on file. And then when the ballots come back, the first thing that's done after the just initial count of the total ballots received, the election official compares the signature on the outside of the envelope to the signature that we have on file with their voter registration record. This is really the make it or break it point. If it doesn't match on that first pass, we do have some secondary checks that we do. And ultimately, we will contact the voter and let them know their signature maybe has changed or they forgot to sign the envelope, and they have up until almost certification day, which in our state is either 10 to 20 days after election day, to cure that signature, update it, and have their ballot counted.
And with mail-in voting, how do you do with voter participation rates?
You know, we are always in the top 6 to 10 states in terms of turnout. And in fact, in our presidential primary that we held on March 10th, which was the week after Super Tuesday, we right now have the highest turnout across the country. And we had COVID impacts the last few days of voting.
Yeah, when Washington State voted, it was right in the midst of the outbreak there in the nursing home, especially. Now, you are a Republican in a blue state. Do you think that this would work on a national scale?
I do think it could work on a national scale. There are some challenges that are there, and I think that we have to be very candid and thoughtful how we move forward, because Washington State, we took about 10 years to ramp up just our absentee voting, where any voter could, for any reason, get an absentee ballot for every election. Then in 2005, our legislature allowed us to move to vote by mail by choice, and it still took our state 5 years to ramp up and convert completely to vote by mail. So, you know, states that are contemplating this have to realize that there's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be built in, not only machinery to be more efficient in how you process those ballots, but also just having the personnel to ramp it up. There is not going to be any perfect solution in COVID-19, you know, mitigation for any state to not be impacted. We still have a lot of people on the backside that have to process ballots. So while we don't have polling places in Washington State, we have vote centers located in each county, and people can drop their ballots off on election day there.
So you're saying it would be difficult. Do you think it's doable to make mail-in voting an option for every American by November?
It will take a really large number of resources. I do think it is possible. The nice thing is that states around the country right now are working really hard to ensure that our voters can vote. My colleagues across the country we're having conversations, if not daily, we're having them at least weekly, talking about, you know, how do you make this possible? How do we get the infrastructure built out? How do we hire enough people? And all of those questions we're working together on, quite frankly, in a way we couldn't have done 4 years ago. I think that the best thing that came out of all of the Russian interference that we heard about in 2016 is that election officials across the country have been working on plans for cybersecurity, and we have communication channels we didn't before, and it's much more robust, and I think those conversations are really helping us get to the point where we could do voting at home, really, across the country.
That is Kim Wyman, who is the Secretary of State in Washington State, which is a state that holds elections entirely by mail. Kim Wyman, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
And let us know what you think. Should all voting be done by mail later this year at hereandnow.org?
Tomorrow is the first of the month. We've talked about what that means for most of us, but brick and mortar stores are looking at massive rent payments to their landlords in shopping malls and city blocks that haven't seen foot traffic in weeks. And the layoffs we've seen at restaurants and health clubs are now hitting the retail world. Macy's and The Gap, just two of the latest to announce they're furloughing the majority of their employees. And even Instagram native brands like Everlane are cutting back. Robin Farzad is a host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, Macy's, The Gap, who else?
Yeah, you go up and down any town's commercial corridor and all manner of storefronts outside of maybe grocery or some restaurants have their lights off. So menswear, makeup, the commercial landlords themselves are furloughing staff. So it is truly across the board.
It's really tough. And remind us, what does it mean to be furloughed as opposed to fired or laid off? You get salary, severance, what happens?
It defines by company and depending on union protections. But this idea that we're going to have to let you go for the time being until life comes back to normal, assuming that things do snap back, say, in 3-4 months, we'll bring you back in a staggered fashion. Some of these companies, such as Macy's, are offering health care for a couple of months. Others are offering some other forms of assistance. But it's all, I think, on balance, cold comfort.
Can you get unemployment?
You cannot. You can if you a full-time 40-hour worker in many of these cases. I've been looking through the union explanations on sites of various retailers. There are people, though, who have not made up that 40-hour balance and have to gig to kind of make up the difference.
This is tough. And we've already been talking about the so-called retail apocalypse. It's about 10 years old now. As shopping leaves malls and moves online, now you've got the coronavirus, you've got online shopping. But are we seeing an uptick as more people are at home, or are people tightening their belts?
You know, online's only held up relatively, and in special defensive situations, you look at free shipping of consumer necessities and look at Whole Foods delivery. In the end, as you say, Robin, this is an economic shock, and everybody's worried about rent due or their own paycheck. So if you look at Macy's, which has been lauded for being omnichannel, you know, come to us however you please, online, which is still largely available, is nowhere near strong enough to sustain the primarily brick-and-mortar essence of this business.
So do you think some stores might not make it through this?
I do. I think that's inevitable. These companies, if you notice, we've been covering the retail apocalypse forever.
Right.
That this, I worry that this is going to sound the death knell for many brands that were just trying to live to see some other seasonal reinvention.
Right. But on the other hand, we're reading lists of things that are selling. Lots of craft stuff, lots of home supply. You know, people are finally getting to put in, you know, fix that smoke alarm. But also loungewear.
Yes. You know, your listeners might remember that I'm early to call this. I've been a connoisseur of sweatpants and dad bought clothing for at least a decade. And so we're seeing Gap and Athleta. They're reporting a boom in orders for comfy wear and athleisure wear. There are reports of track suits selling out, you know, high-rise leggings. You really can't make this stuff up.
Because nobody can see you. Look, people are hiring. Just remind us.
Yeah, the essential players in grocery and household staples, pharmacy, you're talking Kroger, Walmart, and even much of what Amazon does. You'll recall it owns Whole Foods. So you think about all the gig platforms that are seeing an unprecedented surge in orders, whether Uber Eats or DoorDash. So hundreds of thousands of job openings across these companies, but we're seeing millions of jobs lost at the same time.
Yeah, it's tough, tough. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
I'm just picturing you in those sweats. Oh, boy. Now we're getting used to stunning statistics. Today's over 160,000 Americans have contracted COVID-19. More than 3,000 have died. Thousands more are reeling at those losses. So we want to take a tender moment now to reflect on one passing. Michael J. O'Brien of Walcott, Connecticut, was just 35 years old. He was a flagman at construction sites with a side gig as a DJ. In fact, on March 10th, Mike DJed at an event in nearby Westchester, New York, one of the country's early hotspots. 16 days later, he died of COVID-19 at St. Mary's Hospital in Waterbury, Connecticut. His wife, Tara O'Brien, remains in the hospital. Mike's father, Bill O'Brien, is here to help us understand something that those statistics say many Americans will experience and to share some of what others may soon go through. And Bill, to you and your wife and Mike's siblings and nieces and nephews, we are just so sorry.
Thank you, Robin.
Yeah.
Appreciate the concern and so much interest in what's happening to help spread the word around that people need to be careful.
Yeah. Well, it just sounds unbelievable. And it also sounds like Mike enjoyed a big, close family. He was the youngest of four of your children. When he got this cough early on, he thought it was allergies. But your daughter, his sister, got concerned?
Yeah, well, she was concerned for herself. She gets bronchitis almost yearly. My wife was in the hospital last September twice for lung problems, and she's off oxygen now during the day, but she still has it at night. And then my daughter also knew that that Mike, you know, sort of got allergies and or bronchitis each year as well. So you know, she was very much concerned for all three, as we all were.
Yeah. And then your other son, another son in Maryland, said, go to the hospital. This is now 8 days later. How sick was Mike at that point?
I mean, I first knew that he was sick. You know, of course, he lives across town from us, not in the house. And he did go to Westchester County on the 10th. And I think it was maybe 2 days later or so that the governor shut down the bars in New York.
Oh, boy.
But, you know, then by that weekend, I guess Mike was showing symptoms. And over the weekend and then in the next week, he got, you know, sicker. And you know, the last we heard was that his temperature was 104.5, and he went to the walk-in clinic, and he had to sit in the car with his wife for 4 hours before they would let him in, because I guess there was a long line or whatever, and they were only letting in one patient at a time. So they gave Mike the, since he had more of the symptoms, they gave him the virus test. And, of course, we didn't get the results for 2 days later, but, they sent him right to the emergency room and was admitted.
You know, Bill, I don't know if it's even more painful to look back, but I'm wondering, do you have a little of the woulda, shoulda, coulda? I mean, there really was not the language that we hear now back in early March.
Right. Well, you know, my wife did speak to him before he went down to Westchester that night and encouraged him not to go, because we were starting to hear about things in New Rochelle. And, of course, we're just speculating that that's where it happened. But,
right. But
it was not only Mike, but his wife, obviously, you know, has since become sick, and his two business partners as well, who were all there, all four of them, and now one of his business partners, the wife and two children, you know, they've all tested positive.
Well, that's just awful. And your son, at this point in the story, in the hospital, he's seriously ill, and you can't go in.
For us, that was the hardest part, not being able to visit him, be with him, talk to him. We couldn't talk to him on the phone. After the first day, he was on a ventilator. You know, the staff there was great. You know, we had one family member calling, like, taking turns three times a day. You know, the chaplain staff was tremendous, too, you know, getting holy water and doing an apostolic pardon, but that had to be done from outside the room by the chaplain. Mm-hmm. You know, he was not allowed into the room. So it was sort of everything by long distance, but the people there were great. In fact, we even heard that the nurse blessed Mike with holy water every day.
Is that some solace?
Well, I went down twice, once with my wife. We just parked outside the hospital and just prayed the rosary. And when we got the word that, you know, that he was in trouble, we rushed down, and we got there, I guess, just as he was dying, and we're outside the hospital. This time we knew better where he was, you know, out above the emergency room, so we parked back there on the other side of the hospital from where we had been, and that was as close as we could get, probably a couple hundred feet away, but a couple stories up. And, but his wife, Tara, in the meantime, she got admitted to the hospital as well. The next morning, she was brought to ICU, and within the day that Tara went in, I guess Mike started showing some signs that things weren't quite as good as everyone had hoped. And, you know, at some point, I guess right near the end, one of the nurses had Tara, you know, they brought her into the room, and, you know, as Mike died, she was holding Mike's hand. So she was, you know, she didn't see, you know, all of the work that the doctors, I guess they worked on for a couple hours, and they shocked him twice. They did everything they possibly could. But she was there at the very end. And, of course, she's still there now. And she did come out of ICU Monday, and she's up and walking a little bit.
I just, you know, I can't get over the image of you and your wife and family members parked outside. Parking lots are becoming sacred places, right, because you can't go in.
Right, yeah.
And although I'm so sad that Tara is also, in, you know, battling COVID-19, that's the only reason she got to be with him.
I think God had something to do with that.
Well, this is, you know, it's just heartbreaking. People from your state, you have a state senator, Rob Sampson, who, you know, your son's death was a wake-up call for him. I suppose there's no solace, you know, in the loss of a son, but that your son really brought home to people, this is happening.
Right, and from China, we were getting the message that, you know, it's more the elderly that it's hitting, and but they were saying people with underlying conditions, and Mike did have diabetes, but still, that he's only 35, you know, I think was, so far as I know, still the youngest in the state to have died from it. So and that his coworkers and his wife got it as well, shattering any myths that people might have had. And the four of them were in the car together, I guess, or at the bar together, and that they all got it shows how contagious it is.
What would you like us to know about Mike?
Mike was, he was his own kind of guy. He liked to do his own thing. You know, he wasn't, you know, this flashy kind of guy. He didn't like conflict. He had his, you know, circle of friends, and, you know, they confided in him. He was always one that would lend an ear to people, you know. You know, he did things quietly, but he really enjoyed the karaoke and the being able to entertain people. He really wanted to entertain people, but I think especially the weddings. He was extremely interested in a lot of things, from theater to astronomy, and big Star Trek fan.
Well, Bill, you've left out the one thing that really made us smile in this very sad obituary. He was the family birthday cake artist.
That's right. Yeah, my sister-in-law lives with us, his aunt, and she was reminding me that on her birthday he made a Scooby-Doo cake with all the characters on it. And
best cake ever.
So, best
cake
ever.
You never knew what you were going to get. You know, we'd put whatever he thought would be appropriate on there for the person. That part I'm certainly sure is going to be missed on every birthday. In fact, you know, unfortunately, he died on my daughter's birthday. Mm. So that's going to be, you know, hard on her each year. Yeah. But we'll have to do something special on the cakes, I think.
Yeah. Well, Bill O'Brien, again, talking to us about his son, Mike O'Brien, who died at the age of 35 from COVID-19. You know, I know you're not able to have a proper funeral because, you know, people can't be there. But I'm glad we were able to celebrate him here.
Well, we appreciate your calling and putting him on so other people will know a little bit more about Mike.
Yeah.
Really appreciate that.
And by the way, we heard Joan O'Brien, Bill's wife, coaching him there in the background. We thank them both.
How are kids processing the coronavirus pandemic? The shutdown of schools, daycare, businesses, the social distancing, the job losses, the reports of sickness and death. Joining us now by Skype is Janine Dominguez, a clinical psychologist in the Anxiety Disorder Center at the Child Mind Institute in New York. Janine, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and the only thing that I can think of in recent memory that you could compare this moment to when it comes to how kids are processing it is 9/11, which, of course, you know, made a very big difference in all of our lives and especially must have been frightening for children. What are you thinking of as you think about how kids are processing this and what it means to them?
Yeah, I think certainly the change in routine and the change in everyday life can certainly feel anxiety provoking and is also very stressful. But I think the hope is that as we're coaching parents on having open communication with their kids and with their kiddos around what is happening and keeping it in a way that's factual, keeping it about what's happening in the moment, and that what we're all doing together is to help keep each other healthy and safe and keep others healthy and safe. And I think if we can package it in that way, it provides a protective factor in terms of anxiety and other things that might come from something that seems really uncertain.
But I imagine there would be some parents who'd be worried about telling their kids too much about what's going on because they don't want to scare them.
Yeah, I do think that there's a balance. Certainly not talking about it at all can actually provide more anxiety, since kids obviously know that there's a difference and there's something happening. So one way of maybe not providing too much information or providing the right amount of information in terms of developmental level is by taking your child's lead. And maybe you start off by asking them what they know or what they think they know about what's happening and about the coronavirus. So that way you can provide information where there is misinformation and really do it at their level. And then I also think just for parents in general, We want to be informed, of course, but too much information, even for parents, can be anxiety provoking. So I would even caution parents to limit how much consumption they are having in terms of coronavirus news, because it can be almost like you're carrying too much as well. Kids can also pick up on that.
Would parents be able to tell immediately if their children are anxious about what's going on? Do young kids in particular have the vocabulary to explain their feelings?
You know, with the adjustment of a new normalcy and a new routine, there's going to be some feelings around that. And so with younger kids, you might see that more behaviorally, maybe with more temper tantrums or maybe physical symptoms, stomach aches, headaches. And with older children, I think they have more of the vocabulary to say they're feeling nervous or anxious. Both younger kids and older kids might seek out more reassurance, asking questions around whether we're going to be okay, what's going to happen next. Once, you know, a couple weeks go by and we're kind of already in a new normal, if those questions keep happening, if there's still a lot of anxiety symptoms, it might be time to potentially reach out to a mental health provider and maybe provide some help in that way.
As someone who grew up in a big family with a lot of brothers and sisters, I have to say, just the idea of everybody having to spend all day in the same place could probably cause some issues.
Yeah, I think that for myself, just being able to balance working from home and being present as a parent and helping my child also do some school at home, also having my partner work from home, we're all sort of balancing that time. And I think there's going to be some time to adjust to that. I also think that there can be some silver lining to this. You're actually getting to maybe reconnect with one another and reconnect as a family. And there's going to be some, I'm sure, bumps around along the road. And that's totally normal.
It's interesting, in this crisis, it seems like there are three buckets of people. People who are worried first and foremost about the health impacts of coronavirus, people who may have lost their jobs or their income because of the coronavirus, and then people who still have their health and they still have their income, but they're in a very strange situation just because they're working from home, they're staying home with their kids, or they're the kid that's home with their parents. And that's a different and difficult change as well.
Yeah, I think that all three buckets are experiencing some level of change, and I assume too some level of uncertainty as it comes to planning or the future, and that can be really daunting and certainly add to anxiety and stress. And being able to just make it about the here and now and focus on the things that you can control in the moment. And even though this is incredibly difficult, I think practicing some radical acceptance around the things you can't really control right now also can help to alleviate some of that anxiety and stress.
That is Janine Dominguez, who's a clinical psychologist in the Anxiety Disorder Center at the Child Mind Institute in New York. Janine, thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Robin, I mentioned my big family there. We did do a family Zoom the other day, and it looked like the starting scene to the Brady Bunch. But no Alice, right?
And everybody had red hair.
Exactly. Here and Now, production of NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.